Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Dick Merrick, a publisher, author, editor, has done many different things in publishing. How are you, Dick?
I'm very well, thank you. Good. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, I'm happy to do this. And we are doing this in person. Most of the interviews I do are over the phone, but yeah. It's fortunate that we live near one another and I'm able to talk to you in person, which I think is more personal and fun. So maybe we could just start. You could talk a little bit about your where you started in publishing and
sure.
how you got into the career that you had.
Well, I started in publishing at the Macmillan Publishing Company, which in those days, and we're now talking almost 60 years ago, was a publisher that did a lot of books that lasted for months or years or decades. Reptiles of the World, The Secretary's Handbook. And I was hired to refurbish those books and to make them, bring them up to date. Mostly the authors were dead. I would hire somebody else to do them. I would put new jackets on and so on. It was a phenomenally successful program that could not possibly be done today. And I went from that into being an editor. And an editor in my years acquired books and was the chief acquirer of books. Now it's ruled by the sales department. It's ruled almost entirely by economic considerations. But when I started, and I started at Macmillan and then went on to Crown Publishing and then to Dell. When I was doing that, it was the editor was excited about a book and could publish it.
Right.
If he could convince his boss that it was worth publishing.
And the boss in this case would be the publisher.
Was the publisher.
Right. Yes. So you basically the acquiring process was an agent or you found something on your own. Probably there were fewer agents then.
There were fewer agents. They were more powerful. And I worked mostly at publishing houses like Macmillan or Crown that were not first choices of agents. I used to get manuscripts like this, and the first 40 pages were right. bent over and then went right. back to the agent, who didn't bother them to retype them or re-have them done, and just sent them.
But did you get stuff, as they said, over the transom?
Got some stuff over the transom, but mostly it was my own invention. There was a piece in the Times about a girl named LaToya Hunter, who graduated from a black public school in Pelham. And the teacher was quoted as saying, "This girl is amazing. She's smart, and I'm so happy that she was in my class." So I called her up and I said, "Would you like to write a diary of your first year in high school?" And we went back and forth and so on, but we finally did it. And so she kept, every day, she kept a small diary of what her life was like in high school and her feelings and her maturing and so on. During Christmas, her mother watched her, so all she could do was say how wonderful it was to have the family over here, which was obviously a lie. But the rest of it was very honest and very sweet. And she and I are still in contact.
So you created a book.
It was one of the most successful books I've ever published.
Really?
Yes.
How much editing did you have to do?
None. I left it entirely in her words.
What was the book called?
It was called The Diary of LaToya Hunter.
Is it still in print?
I believe so.
Wow.
And this was a long time ago. Yeah. It may not be in print, but I think it is.
That's
interesting.
It
is, yeah.
Right. So, I still think that may happen today.
Yes.
Editors are able to see something in the news
sure.
or find an article by somebody they think would make an interesting book.
Yeah.
But you're right. The process, well, again, to go back to the process then, you could individually convince a publisher to publish the book
right.
based on your enthusiasm
right.
and your belief in the book,
mm-hmm.
which
no
I think I've heard from other editors who've been working for a long period of time that it was more like that then, and obviously no longer is, except for the rare editor who may be able to.
Well, yes, I mean the Jason Epstein's of the world.
Right, or Michael Peach. Yeah, there are a few editors who have enough stature that they could do it.
Yeah, but Michael Peach runs the company.
Now
and
runs
Jason,
the company. Exactly.
And Jason, if he didn't run it, who was God?
Right. So, but it just your background before you became involved in publishing. Did you have any? What got you to go into publishing? How did when you said you got hired to do this work at Macmillan? How'd you get there?
I started because my father was a friend of a man named Herbert Mays, who was the editor of Good Housekeeping Magazine, publisher and editor. Just the editor in chief. And I worked for Good Housekeeping Magazine for a while, went into the Army, came back. Herbert moved to McCall's, and I wrote a column called Sight and Sound for McCall's, which were reviews of books, movies, and so on. What sounded like a glamorous job, but it really gets very wearing very quickly. In any case, I didn't like it, and I wanted to get out. And I read a book by Peter DeVries called The Blood of the Lambs, and it's the only serious book that Peter DeVries wrote. And it was about his daughter, the death of his daughter from cancer. And I had had a child who died in infancy. But it hit me so hard. And I called Little Brown, which was the publisher. I reviewed the book for McCall's. I called Little Brown, and it turned out that the editor of the book was in New York. Little Brown was in Boston, but Alan Williams was the editor, and I called him up. And I told him my experience, that I had wept reading this book and how beautiful it was and wonderful. And P.S. I wanted to get out of the magazine business, and how did I get a job in publishing? And Alan was wonderful. I mean, he took me out to lunch and just made the phone calls. And I finally wound up with Macmillan. And that's how I got
pretty. That's a pretty, well, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people who have entered publishing have had similar experiences. It's just you took a job or you called somebody and, you know, you ended up with a job.
Yeah.
It wasn't. I mean, some people have said I was desperate to be in publishing, but I think a lot of people, it just sort of fell into it.
I loved books. I wanted my whole life to be around books. I loved music. My father was in the music business, so I didn't want to be in the music business. And that's, you know, I've never deviated from that, and I continue to love it.
So you were an editor in various publishing houses for some period of time.
Never less than 4 years. And my first boss, a guy named Peter Rittner, I don't know if you knew him, fabulous man, strange, and eventually committed suicide. But anyway, Peter told me that you shouldn't be at any one place more than 5 years, because if you've been at a publishing house for 5 years, you know exactly what buttons to push to get the book you want published. And there's no challenge. And a whole different set of ideas on a book would be very helpful. Right. So I did that. It meant that 401ks were not part of my graduation, but it was fun. It was fun.
So, and at what point did you become a publisher then?
I became a publisher when I was hired away from the Dial Press to become the head of St. Martin's.
And when was that? What year was that?
15 years ago.
Okay.
Maybe.
So you were an editor for a really long time.
Long time. And edited books. I'll tell you a couple of stories. One of them was the editing of Robert Ludlum, who a fellow named Alan Rinsler, still alive, working in California, was at Macmillan when I was at Macmillan. And he bought this book for, I think, $1,200. And it was a monstrous thing. And at Macmillan, you had to get a corroborating reading from another editor. And obviously, we didn't take time to do the corroborating. We really just wrote, Alan's absolutely right, this book will. And Alan was fired for reasons that were totally Macmillan and ridiculous. I mean, he was a brilliant editor. And my boss, Peter Rittner, looking through the memos and his files, said, oh, I see you like the book called The Scarlatti Inheritance by Robert Ludlum. And I said, oh, absolutely.
You hadn't read it.
I hadn't read it. And he gave it to me, and he said, well, it's yours.
So then you did read it.
Then I did read it, appalled. It was 1,500 pages, and Mr. Ludlum could not write. Couldn't write. Didn't have the faintest notion about its structure, something, or anything like it. It was just, but it had, the book, two things. One was that it had a terrific central character, a woman named Elizabeth Scarlatti, and the other was that he, coming from the theater, he was an actor and a show producer, the Paper Mill Playhouse, I think. Yeah. And he knew how to end a scene so that you wanted to get to the next scene. Those two skills he had. And I remember I called his agent, Henry Morrison, and I said, I'm the new editor of this. And then when I left Macmillan to follow Peter, who took up editor-in-chief of World Publishing. And I went and called Henry and I said, I want to take Ludlum with me. And he said, you're kidding. And I said, no, I mean, there's something here. And Bob and I worked on that book for, I would guess, 2.5 years. Now, that's absolutely impossible today. You couldn't do it. People would think you were completely nuts.
No, within, if you did it within the publishing company, you couldn't.
Yeah, no, within the publishing company, exactly.
You could do it, and I think writers, we've talked about this outside of this recording, authors now hire editors,
of course,
to do just that.
Yes, I'm one of those editors.
Right, or their agents will do it.
Sure,
because books, and this I think illustrates something really important, books just don't spring out of nowhere.
They sure don't.
Even great books, or maybe especially great books, it's rare. Writers don't just sit down, write a great novel, get up from the table, and hand it in.
Right, they certainly don't.
With some few exceptions. There must be a few.
James Joyce, I don't think.
Right, but he didn't want to be edited either.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. So
I had a terrific fight with Cynthia Ozick. Very, very good writer.
Yeah.
And she said, I refuse to have an editor touch my book. And I said, you're crazy. You know, you're working on an objective, you're working on a subjective thing which needs an objective eye. That's what editors do.
That's right.
When I wrote a novel in 1987 called Works of Genius. And I sold it finally to Athenaeum, which was absolutely the happiest day of my life. Never mind having children. I mean, anybody can have children. But my agent called after many, many turn downs and said, Athenaeum's going to buy the novel. I went wild with joy. And I sent it, and I got a 9-page, single-spaced letter from my editor pointing out things that I would have caught in anybody else's manuscript.
Right, but you couldn't see it in your own.
Couldn't see it in my own.
Well, that's actually, I think what you just described is what the value of an editor is.
Sure.
I mean, 9 pages of single-spaced review of a novel.
Page 37.
Right.
Do this.
Right.
You just said that.
That's incredible. Right. I mean, that I think, it illustrates what editors do.
Sure.
And I think in some respects, writers today, I mean, it is sort of trite to say this because I know it's not always true, but I think it's missed in publishing.
You bet.
And there are some books that I've read that were published and published by reputable presses that were missing quite obviously the level of editing that you've just described.
Yeah.
Not unedited. I think people say broad brush, you know, they'll say, oh, nobody edits anymore. And that's not true.
Of course it's not true.
But I think there are some books which don't get as much attention as they could have gotten, or that editors are not given that amount of time, which you just, I think what you just pointed out is really important. The 2.5 years, it's commercially unfeasible.
Alan was fired from Macmillan because he worked for 2 years anyway on an unknown black man's book. I don't know, I've just lost the name. Damn it, I'll think of it in a second. The book was Man-Child in the Promised Land.
Oh, my God. Claude Brown.
Claude Brown, which sold God knows how many copies, probably a million copies. And it was worth his 2 years if he had done nothing else. But why are you wasting time on this?
Right. Well, it's harder to take the longer view.
Yeah.
I think the difference that you see seems to be, I think sometimes the criticism of publishing neglects the root cause, you know, and once a company is publicly, it has obligations to shareholders that are based on quarterly results. So it's hard to take a 2-year investment and make that viable.
Cool.
And that's not just publishing. I think that's all American business today is dominated too much by the short-term thinking.
Absolutely. When I was running E.P. Dutton, for instance, I was under terrific pressure, quarterly pressure, to get books out, particularly the final quarter, because
right.
I had to make the figures look good.
Right.
And so I remember calling writers and saying, hurry up.
Which is terrible.
Or taking a book before, when it could have used another one or two edits.
Right.
And publishing. Feeling like an absolute betrayer of the writer.
But unavoidable.
But unavoidable because somebody was over me saying, you know, this is going to be a big book. We ought to publish it now. I've got to have figures in November.
Right. So you'd want to get as much shipped in the fourth quarter
exactly.
as you could. I do know from, this is sort of another irony of publishing in the whole industry, because you're selling fully returnable, so it may as well mm-hmm. be consignment, and
sure.
I always thought the industry really should be on consignment accounting, but come November, December, the trap is you can ship it, whether it sells or not,
yeah.
sells through, doesn't matter to the fourth quarter.
Exactly.
It only matters, and then in the first quarter, you take all those returns. So
and then you have to catch up.
It's an endless cycle where you're eating your tail, basically.
Sure, sure.
And that, I think, in some ways, is a bad dynamic that is not the fault of any editor, not the fault of any publisher.
Right.
You're just doing what you need to do given the system.
Yeah.
So the system has a problem. But no publisher that I know of can break that system.
I certainly couldn't.
Right.
When I was running that, there was no way. But.
Right. You're not going to get away from
yeah.
returnability,
no.
especially today.
No. And they coming back.
So can you just name all the publishers that you worked for
sure.
As an editor?
I worked for Macmillan and went from there to the World Publishing and from there to the Dial Press, where I was hired as the editor-in-chief.
And this was Dial Press in the 80s?
Yeah. And it was run by a wonderful woman named Helen Meyer, who had just bought it. And they had James Baldwin as their top author.
And Dial was independent.
Yeah. And
Fran McCullough was there?
No.
Okay.
It was after that. Anyway, Helen had bought it to get Baldwin. Another story. When I came to Dial, Helen hired me because I was Ludlum's editor. And she believed, rightly, that I could take Ludlum along with me
mm-hmm.
while we bought him out of his contract at World. Anyway, she said, you have a job to do. And I said, what's that? And she said, well, James Baldwin has announced that he's never going to publish another book with us. And you have to fix that.
That's a challenge.
It certainly was. And I went to Jimmy's agent, a guy named Robbie Lance, and said, what do I do? And he said, you get tough with him. It's the only way. If he starts playing you, you're finished. So there was a book that we were about to publish of his, and I worked very hard, and I sent him every single review. I sent him letters. I sent him anything that was in the least bit relevant, and nothing in reply for, I think, 2.5 months, 3 months, something like that. And I got a letter finally from his lawyer saying, Mr. Baldwin wishes to terminate his association with the Dial Press, and goodbye. And I said, no, no, absolutely not. And we had a huge meeting, angry meeting, with a lawyer, and his name was Alan Schwartz, and us, and me mostly. And I just said, under no circumstances will we let him out of his contract. He owes a book to us. He finishes that. That's fine. But he's bringing the book to us. And I wrote to Jimmy again after this meeting. And I said it was Alice in Wonderland because the cat wasn't there. And I said, come on, cat, smile. And I got a call the next day from Paris, from his then mentor, agent, I don't know what position she had, a woman named Tria French, black, and it turns out very beautiful. And I went to Helen, and she was not given to this kind of thing, and I said, A, I have to go to Paris to meet with Tria French, not with Baldwin, and B, I have to stay in a nice hotel. Helen was not big for nice hotels.
Didn't want to spend the money.
No, exactly. And I was so nervous that it was my second trip to Paris, so I knew how good the food was. Couldn't eat. Couldn't possibly eat. Met with Tria, and I had spent the intervening days reading everything of Baldwin, of course. And I liked her immediately, and she liked me. And so I was able to talk cogently about Jimmy. And she said, okay, Jimmy's a Nice. Meet him at the Gresco Hotel, more expensive than wherever I was. And he'll be there at 11 o'clock in the morning, day after tomorrow. So I called Helen and said, this is what's going on. And I was there, and I was sitting in a hotel room, my palms sweating, just sweating with nervousness, and what was I going to say, and so on. I brought him illustrations from a book that he was doing that we were about to publish. And it got to be 1 o'clock. And finally, I was furious. I was really angry. And the concierge called up and said, Mr. Baldwin's downstairs. And I went down, and there he was with Alan Schwartz, the lawyer with whom I had had such a terrible fight, with Tria, and with his very surly, at the moment, Arab lover, young boy. A peacock. And he said, as I sat down, he said, I brought you here to tell you one thing. And I said, what's that? And he said, this nigger ain't going to publish another book for Helen Meyer. And I said, well, fuck you. Like that, it came out. I mean, Baldwin was one of the most important authors. And he said, what? And I said, fuck you. I mean, I came all the way over here. I've written you, didn't have the courtesy to answer. And I guarantee you will never have another book published in the United States. I have no power to do that. I mean, it's ridiculous.
You'll never
And
have
everybody was on his feet saying, well, how dare you talk to... And Baldwin said, wait a minute. He's serious. And I didn't write to him for all that time. He said, let's you and I talk. And we had lunch, 3 bottles of wine, I think, and went on for hours and hours and hours. At the end of it, he gave me a card, which I still have, which allows me free passage when the blacks take over New York City. Or he said, if you can get it out of your pocket in time.
That's super.
And we became friends, and I was his publisher then for many books.
Oh, that's a fantastic story.
I love that. That was one of the high spots of my life.
Well, pretty terrifying.
Oh, boy. And it was pure, my reaction was pure instinct. I had nothing, obviously.
Right. Well, you were, I guess, lucky you played it Right.
Tough.
Yeah.
Tough, the way Robbie had said those many months ago.
But were you thinking about that at that time?
Not at all. No. Not at all.
You just acted like a regular person.
Yeah. Maybe being insulted.
Right. And that's what got through to him, is that you acted like a regular person.
Exactly.
That you were there, the charade of all the other stuff fell away.
Yeah.
And he could finally see you as a human being.
I guess.
But unusual.
Very. And I was white, and he was black, and he was militantly black, and you know, I loved him. I just loved him. He was an extraordinary man, troubled and sad, but brilliant. Anyway, that was. I have one other story to tell you of how publishing is different then.
Yeah.
When I was the head of I think it was Dutton. No, it was of St. Martin's. No, that was, you asked me what houses I had been in, and this was at, I went from Crown to Dial, and from Dial to Dutton, and from Dial to St. Martin's, to St. Martin, from Dial to St. Martin's, and then to Dutton. And when I was at St. Martin's, I think, or maybe it was before that, I had as my editor-in-chief a woman named Joyce Engelson, and we were a team. Every time I went to a publishing house, I said, I don't go without Joyce. And it was the hottest platonic relationship in publishing. I mean, she was just wonderful. And we loved each other. And Joyce brought in a book by a psychiatrist describing a year of residency at a large Boston hospital. And it was very, very funny, but it didn't have a plot. And I went to the head of sales and said, what would you do with a novel which is very, very funny, but doesn't have a plot? And he said, well, I wouldn't buy it. I said, you can't sell it? He said, I have to give it away. And I thought to myself, what a wonderful idea. And we published 10,000 copies of this book. It was called The House of God. And published 10,000 copies, and we portioned them out to publishing houses. And they were stamped with something so they couldn't be returned. And they could buy copies. They had to put them in the window, but they were free. We gave them away to bookstores. And I was reviled. Publishers Weekly wrote a story about it. The New York Times wrote a story about it. And it was, I would guess, $50,000 worth of publicity.
Right, which probably cost you less than that in printing costs.
Totally.
Right.
Totally.
Hardcover book or paperback?
Huh? Hardcover.
Hardcover. So, but in those days, 10,000 copies might have cost you 20 grand. Right.
25,000. Right. Something like that.
So as a publicity stunt, paid off.
Not only did it pay off, but the book went crazy. I mean, it started to sell and sell and sell in hardcover, and the next ones we sent out weren't full.
Right.
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 It was bought by Dell as a paperback, and I think it's one of the top 10 books that they've ever published. Still in print, absolutely.
Well, not a very different approach from what people are doing with ebooks in the giveaway.
Sure.
Model. I mean, there you have to do it in a big way.
Yeah.
And of course, now so many people do it. It's not as, it's no longer publicity.
Right.
But it does provide, I know I've talked to publishers who have done this. You know, you give away you have the free book promotion for ebooks. You might distribute 40,000 copies, and you think that means nobody will ever buy the book because anybody who wanted it got it for free.
Sure.
But what happens is that people who got it for free tell other people, this is a really good book.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might distribute 40,000 free copies and end up selling. I mean, you could sell more than that in the actual paid edition.
Of course.
It doesn't always work. Sometimes the freebie
The book has to be good.
Yeah. And you have to be a little bit lucky that it has to be. I think there's so much about publishing that has to do, I don't want to call it luck in the sense of pure luck, mm-hmm. but it's right place, right time, right book.
Yeah.
And that sometimes is not anything you can control.
Sure.
So you publish a great book and nobody reads it. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that the book was bad. It just means that it didn't hit the resonance in the audience
right.
at that time. Might later,
yeah.
might never. Yeah. I mean, there are some books which never do, but it seems like in order to take advantage of that, you have to publish a lot of books. And this goes to a question that I have. I want to ask you about this because I think that it's true. I think that I am understanding this correctly, but in the period of, let's say, the 80s and 90s, when book selling was growing because of the chains, Barnes mm-hmm. Noble and Borders, yeah. competition, Books a Million, all of these stores being introduced, you'd have more shelf space. And it has always seemed to me that the publishers responded by publishing more books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that by creating more output they actually reduce quality. I'm not even concerned with that. It's right. just the idea, the theory seems to be if you publish a lot of books and you hire really good people to do them,
yes.
so you give all of those books an opportunity to be successful. Some of them will be.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost doesn't matter to the publisher which ones.
Oh, of course.
You can't control it.
Yeah.
So you publish the 1,000 books
sure.
as well as you can. And essentially it's like going to Las Vegas and putting down bets on black or white in the yeah. roulette wheel. You know, you just... But once you start getting traction, then of those 1,000, some number become hits.
Hits, that's right. And that was the model.
Right, so I'm right. That really yeah, was absolutely. The model that you operated
yeah, on. I mean, you don't publish at random. You publish right. any things that you like.
Right, you hedged your bets.
You hedged your bets.
Right.
My boss, Peter Redner, my first one, told me, and he was absolutely right, there's a god of publishing. And while... he is not a major god. I mean, there are more important things to do. He sits at the bottom of the Pantheon, in the cellar.
Right.
And he's very lazy. And he likes chocolates. Doesn't have a television set, so he just reads. And at the end of his room, there's a dartboard. And the dartboard is in slices. Manchester, Random House, right. Naval Institute Press,
right.
whatever. And for exercise, he takes a dart and throws it at the board. And when it hits, a miracle happens to that press.
It's a great image.
No, yes, it really
is. It quantifies right. or you know, kind of makes real the yeah. things that we think yes. are true.
Sure.
That it's really, you create your own luck, but mm-hmm. in the end, it really is somewhat random.
Of course. Absolutely.
Right. Random House has their name for a good reason.
For a good reason. And when that author, of course, a very difficult time is what to do with the next book.
Right.
Because, I mean, you think of what was that Civil War novel made into a huge movie, sold 7 million.
Oh, copies. Cold Mountain.
Cold Mountain.
Yeah.
And
very tough. To do the next
and book. He got $7 million for his next book,
right?
Which sold 12 copies. Right. I mean, I don't know.
Well, there have been many. I think that
many instances like that,
where yeah. because the success was almost like what we were talking about before. It is the magic,
you're
the
right.
miracle. It doesn't mean that they're a better writer or a worse writer than anybody else. It just means that they
yeah.
hit the culture at the right moment in time. The resonant point happened. People talked about the book.
Absolutely.
It got talked about a lot, and then I think there's an algorithmic process, and I know this from sales, that now today, if you get on a bestseller list, now that means Walmart and Target and places right. like that will carry your book. There's a multiplier value then. You know, if Costco, all the mass merchants recognize a successful book, they'll right. carry it. It becomes more successful.
Yes.
Now, I think that's a more recent phenomenon, but it's still true.
Although it used to be true even of supermarkets. Before there were the huge
right.
Costcos and
right, the supermarkets and drugstores
right.
would carry only the best sellers.
Only the best sellers.
So the same thing happened
yeah.
in paperback.
Yeah.
And I think that that creates an illusion for both the author and the publisher
mm-hmm.
then that we've hit something here.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you a question, though, about that, because I think another difference between today and the past, which a lot of people have talked about, is this idea of building an author over time. Mm-hmm. That you're, it's similar to your idea, you know, what you talked about of investing 2.5 years in one book.
Right.
But publishers used to invest years in a career. And we know that that's not happening now to any great extent. There may be a few examples, but for the most part now, I think writers feel, and I think editors will agree, that if the first two books don't make it, mm-hmm. you're pretty much done.
Even the first book.
It might be the first book. Yeah. Although the first book could show some promise.
Right.
You know, yes. I can think of a couple of examples sure. where a book got really good reviews, sold reasonably well, no yeah. home runs, but enough to give the editor a reason to say, I'm going to bet on your next book too. Mm-hmm. But if that second book doesn't do better, then they basically yeah, say, we can't go anymore.
Absolutely.
But in the old days, and not that many years ago to be old, but I think you would see more examples of editors saying, well, you know, we did 5 or 6 books before we really
sure.
found the audience.
Sure.
We built an audience, or we just didn't know where the audience was, and we finally got that god of publishing to maybe not the dart, but at least push the button
yes.
and say, this book yes. is good enough. So now maybe we'll sell 20,000 or yeah. 30,000 copies, and now you're in business.
One of the things that stopped that really from happening more frequently than it used to was agents who would take give 3 books to one publishing house, and when they started to sell, the 4th book was put up for auction.
Which kills the whole idea.
Which kills the whole idea.
It's similar to baseball with free agency.
Sure.
That once you play, teams don't invest as much in the development of a player if they think they're going to lose that player after 7 years or 5
Absolutely.
Years. It's a natural
yeah.
thing. So, that's a very good point, that loyalty works in both directions.
Sure.
So the agents and authors saying, I'm going to get the most I can for mm-hmm. my next book, they kill that notion that
yeah.
you can invest in somebody and have loyalty.
Yeah.
That if I built your career, you're going to stay with me, even if you could have maybe made a little bit more somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good observation.
I published 9 books of Ludlum's, and then he left to go to Random House. Part of that was a fight that we had. But mostly it was for money, just out and out money. And as you know, the Helen was not a big spender. And so I went to Jason.
Right. Although if in that system, you could say, well.
Yeah, that was all right. I mean, we had gotten.
Right, and the backlist is going to make money. So your investment is repaid.
Sure.
Even though that person, that author,
yeah.
moved to another house,
yeah.
you've still got the books you published.
Mm-hmm.
And even if Random House has a bigger success with the 8th book,
yeah.
it helps pull 1 through 7 yeah. forward. So in a kind of way, the ecosystem changed,
mm-hmm.
but it still doesn't. That in itself didn't kill off the idea yeah. of developing authors over time.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the big authors are exceptional. It's the ones in that mid-range who have the most trouble, I think. You know, where
absolutely.
You used to have what they called mid-list authors, who were, they could publish 8 or 10 novels, never break through, but
yeah.
never, they're not hurting you,
and
you're making a little money.
And it was easy to figure out how much to pay them, what kind of advances to.
Right, because you knew what their last book did.
You knew what the last book did.
Right. And I know, I have a friend who's now, she wrote maybe, I think, 7 or 8 novels, 9
mm-hmm.
novels. None of them broke through.
Right.
Nobody will talk to her anymore.
Yeah.
I know a couple of, I mean, there's several, I mean, many novelists who are in that position who had what they thought were an arc toward staying able to, being able to continue as a novelist
yeah.
commercially. I don't think they can do that
anymore. I don't think
But what other kind of key differences do you see? I mean, people talk about the difference between today and the past, but just thinking about the future as much as the past and the present, what do you see happening in the next few years? How do you think this is?
God knows where it's going. But there are a couple of constants, at least one constant, and that is that somewhere in the world, somewhere in America, somewhere in Connecticut, somebody has an idea for a book that's important and wonderful. And he just sits down, or she, and writes it without thinking about anything. I mean, he'd love to get it published, or she'd love to get it published, but it's important to this person.
Right.
And that will never stop. Storytelling is so ingrained in us. It goes back as far as it goes. So there will always be a publishing industry.
So you would say, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there, sometimes people have said, authors in particular, you know, without advances, we lose all of these, lots of books don't get written.
Right.
And I think that may be true, but what you're saying is the imperative is not financially driven. If you really have to write.
Not the really good ones. Right. You know, I freelance edit now, and most of the people who come to me want their books published because they want to make money, and they've written what is, in quotes, a commercial book. It's generally pretty bad, and it will not sell. I mean, they'll have to self-publish.
Right.
But there are, every once in a while, ones that come along which are just magic.
When you, now, as you are no longer an editor, commercial, you're not, you no longer have an employed position as an editor or publisher, freelance, self-employed, you write and you edit. So if, let's say you came across a book and you knew could be published, should be published, do you call somebody up you know and say, you got to take this? Or do you call an agent?
Yeah, I call an agent.
You've got to sign this person up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so when you do your own writing, because how many books have you written now?
Well, I've ghostwritten. I've only had one novel published. The second novel was much better.
And not published?
Nobody published. Terrible. And the first book, that, you know, is one of the 10 best books on the LA Times Christmas list or whatever it was. But nobody bought the second book, and so I decided that was no way to live. It was the agony of that turndown was too painful. It was autobiographical in the widest sense, that it was a thriller, but there were themes in it that made me, that were very personal. And to be rejected like that was just horrible. So I put ghostwritten. And that's something else again. That's a job.
Right. But now when you ghostwrite, do you get, sometimes you get credit and sometimes not?
I've asked for no credit almost always on the spine, because it's the author's or my collaborator's story. But I insist upon an acknowledgement.
Right, that you get mentioned.
So that, for the industry.
Right. Because it's your credit.
Yeah, it's my credit.
I mean, it is a credit, but it's, I understand, it's not, you're not going on the cover as Joe Schmoe told to or written with. You don't do that.
No.
But you could.
I could.
I mean, in some cases, it might be good for you. Maybe. Or good for the author.
Maybe.
But you also freelance edit.
I freelance edit, so
So, and how do you find people?
Mostly,
how do you find clients?
Mostly through agents.
Right, so they know who you are.
Sure.
They know the quality of work you can do and the level of editing that you're capable of. So you get, they will call you if they see a book that has commercial potential. Mm-hmm. And because their thinking is, if I bring a book with commercial potential to a publisher, they're not going to have time to edit it,
that's
or they're
right.
not. They'd rather have the finished book.
Sure.
Now, when that happens, though, do you feel that a publisher then says, "You know, this is edited now; it's finished," and they know that you did it,
right?
But they might still say, "Well, we want to change a few things here and there."
Fine.
Do you work? Are you still involved then, or are you're done?
No, I'm done.
Right.
When the agent sells the book, I'm done.
Right. And you don't get. You just get paid a fee. You're not getting a.
I get paid a fee.
Right.
And when I ghostwrite, I get paid a royalty.
Right, a fee and a royalty?
Often an advance
fee against. Right.
But I don't know, to go back to your question, the future of publishing, I don't know, and I don't think anybody does, what this revolution, and it's as different now as it, you know, from whenever I started, totally different, totally different. What the net, what ebooks effect are going to have. I don't think people know yet.
No, I don't think we do. People make predictions all the time.
Sure.
You know, I think you know that you can make a prediction about what will happen next year.
Yes.
With some sense of maybe knowing what you're talking about.
6% more sales this way or that way.
Right.
Yeah.
But once you go out beyond a year, there are so many variables, so many things. I just heard on the news the organization that does annually a prediction of world trends. Mm-hmm. It's mostly geopolitical.
Right.
And they said that in 2008 they had predicted something like what occurred in the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. But they had predicted it for something like somewhere in the next 15 years. And then it happened in the next 2 years.
Right.
So you know that the future is so fluid and so difficult. And what will happen is someone will create something new that was unpredictable. That's by its nature. Mm-hmm. That could change things.
Sure.
Or something will happen that no one expected. And that will have a significant effect.
That's called the internet. I mean, you don't...
That's right.
You don't... Before there was an internet...
Right.
Changed everything.
There are new book publishing ventures being created on a daily basis. For some reason, people think that publishing is really fun.
And they're right.
And they are right. But it is interesting how many new ideas come along. Good or bad, we don't know. But and you know that Goodreads has 13 million people and Library Thing has some millions more. You know, those were not predictable 5 or 6 years ago.
Sure.
So, no, I didn't mean to put you on the spot in that way, but more...
There will be books.
Well, yes.
I find that very encouraging.
I think that's a good thing to remember.
Yeah.
And I also think that people are reading still, maybe more, because of there are so many different opportunities to read. Right. We may not read, books may not be the same as they were.
I don't know if you'll actually have an artifact.
Right, might not.
Yeah.
Or you might have, like there is today, vinyl records for a limited number of people.
Right.
And CDs still for some people.
Sure.
And then digital for a lot of people.
And there'll be great art books where the printing has to be absolutely spectacular.
Right.
Will probably always exist until the internet gets so good that they'll be able to do it.
Right. Or if your printers, the home printers, get so good, that I could send you a file and you could print that work of art. I mean, in fact, the printers now that the Giclée printers, which are incredibly good. They're expensive, but who knows? Maybe there could be one in every town, and you could have an art book printed for you on demand the way, the espresso machine does print books. Well, now this has been really fun to talk to you about. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that I forgot to ask you?
No, you know about the internet the way I don't. I mean, e-books the way God knows I don't. Having had that horrible experience of having a book published by you as an ebook. I mean, you did a wonderful job, but didn't sell.
Right, which is true. I think I heard a statistic recently that of the however many millions of ebooks that were published in the last year, the average sale was like 50 copies per book.
Yeah.
Because
you did very well.
Yeah, you did better than the average. But it is true that there are lots of books. The thing that we haven't figured out in all of this quantity of production is how you can connect people to the book when it's not on a physical shelf, not in a physical
space.
Maybe
there's a God of ebooks. The 50 Shades of Grey is a miracle.
That's right. It is a miracle.
Yeah.
I think there is a God. Maybe it's a goddess of ebooks.
Maybe.
And but she is not yet fully formed.
No.
She hasn't...
And her taste is rotten.
That's... Well...
But, that's all you can say.
Great. Yeah. I think that's great. Well, I like the God of publishing is something I'm never going to forget.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that.
Anyway, this was great fun.
Thank you, Dick. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry, books in general. I've been talking to Dick Merrick. It's been great fun. Thank you.